Hello, today is December 23rd, and we are continuing in our class on Hashem. God is the main character of our semester. We just finished a few weeks on Akedat Yitzchak, and now we're embarking on Perek Chof Gimel in Sefer Bereishis. Okay, there are two stories on page 48. It's Parshas Chayesara, and this Parsha is rather in a class by itself in Sefer Bereishis, because there are just two stories in the Parsha, two chapters, chapter 23 and 24, just a little bit of 25, but 23 is the death of Sarah and the burial of Sarah. 24 is finding a wife for Yitzchak, right? And then 25 is just a little introduction into Parshas Toldos to tell us some of the background of Yishmael. So the reason why I say this Parsha is unique in Sefer Bereishis is because God is not found in this Parsha. Mm-hmm. Not in the active voice, not in the passive voice. God is not at Sarah's funeral, doesn't instruct Avraham in any way. Avraham doesn't call out to God in any way there. In the finding a wife for Rivka, is also God isn't part of the system. No one says that God I'll say this. In the beginning of the story, Avraham tells his servant before he finds this match for Yitzchak, that God will send an angel before you to make you succeed. Okay, we do not see any angel in the story that makes Avraham's servant succeed in any way, but we do see that he acts with a certain type of brazenness. He acts with something the Gemara calls nichush, divination, mm-hmm. with his plan that whoever comes out with water, not only for me, but for my camels as well, then I know that will succeed. I will give him a chutzpah to think that that's a good thing to do. Avram didn't give him any strategies. He just said, go find a good wife. And he told him where to go also. I mean, he knew he wasn't going blindly. So there, the key to understanding that part. And I'm going backwards in Parshas Chayesara from finding the wife back to the death of Sarah, is that the key to understanding why he behaves this way is that he is called earlier in Bereishis Damesek Eliezer. And while he's never named in chapter 24, Rashi and Ramban say simple pshat. The way he's described, the Moshel B'chol Asher Lo, Zakan Beiso, That could only be Eliezer, who's described earlier in Bereishis as the one inheriting Avraham, right? He's the man described in chapter 15, where Avraham tells God, "How can you tell me I'm going to be a great nation when my whole future is wrapped up in?" And there he names Eliezer. And he says, "The man from Damascus." Damascus is the capital of Aram. Mm-hmm. He was going back home. He knew the territory. He was going back home from where he came from to find a wife for his master's son. He knows that in Aram at this time, we know this from Aramaic sources, but we also know it from Torah sources. Do you remember when Lavan talks to Yaakov in Parshas Vayetze, when Yaakov starts to leave without giving him information? Remember he said how he knew that Yaakov was responsible for all the good things that happened to him? Remember what he said? Nichashti, I made divination, says Lavan, and I knew that I can't harm you in any way. So Eliezer chooses to find a wife for his master's son using divination. It looks like divination. Right? The Gemara in Maseches Chulin seems to say that he acted in a way that is prohibited. If it was a Hebrew, and he was an Israelite, the Torah. Now, interesting that Tosfos, if I may just take this little lumdus for a moment, Tosfos mentions the opinion that in the Sechah Sanhedrin that we believe that B'nai Noah are also forbidden to divination. So the question is not so much how could the righteous servant of Avraham violate his what's expected of him? No. Well, I think the more the question is, how could such a violation lead to such a profound success?
Yes.
Usually violations in the Torah don't lead you to such success. You know, that the marriage of Yitzchak should be based on a violation, chas v'shalom. So the answer that the Ran asks this question on the Gemara in Chulin that mentions it, and the Ran says, as do some of the commentaries to Rashi, the Ran says that this would be divination if it didn't make sense. If the idea of how to, the test of how to find a wife for Yitzchak didn't make sense, which would be he went out and he said, okay, God, I really don't know where to turn. My master said you would send me an angel, so this is the deal. The first girl that comes out wearing a white dress, that's the one that you obviously have set aside to marry my master's son. Then that would be ridiculous, unless white was some special color that was very rare or something. I don't know. Or the first girl who comes out wearing a certain type of garment or any, I don't know, anything else that's certainly beyond your control, mm-hmm. right? These are just things that just parenthetically post can discuss this. Let's say you really have an important decision to make and you just can't make up your mind, right? Can you flip a coin? That's not in your hands. Can you go outside and say, I'm gonna walk up to Columbus. If the first car that drives by is a domestic car, I'm gonna do X. And if it's a foreign car, I'm gonna do Y. That's beyond your control, it's divination. But to say the first girl that acts in this chesed way and acts for me and mine as well as my camels, so then you're harnessing a divine trait. Right? When the human being behaves in a way of that connotes chesed, then we are bringing God into the story, even though he may not be there. It's really stark that God does not appear at Sarah's funeral, and God does not appear in the whole story, the entire story of finding a wife for Yitzchak. And then right in Toldos, God talks to Yitzchak. God, you know, God is usually in all of our stories. Well, I'm not up to the Yosef story yet. God is going to take a holiday again, but he's here. This is just a profound message, especially in Sefer Bereishis, is that God exists. His power is harnessed through the human act of Chesed. What do we say this? I mean, God is a lot of things for us, right? Human being can define God like Yeshayahu says, you can't come up with anything that actually defines God. So you think of human characteristics that God is he like the Mahu Rachum Mafato Rachum Mahu Chanun Mafato Chanun. You know, he's merciful, so you be merciful.
Attributes.
So and the attributes of God that we're supposed to imitate because we're in the image. But these are all called anthropopathic. Anthropopathic attributes means that God doesn't get happy, he doesn't get sad, he doesn't get angry, he doesn't. So he's based on Pesukim in Tanakh. Yahu says in chapter 7, do you think I ever get angry? I don't get angry. What are you talking about? There are 2,000 Pesukim in the Bible that says God is angry.
Yeah.
Right? No. God can make it stop raining. That's a sign that God's angry. Not that God is actually angry, but the drought is a sign that God is manifesting some kind of displeasure with our activity. So why do I pick on chesed as the ultimate defining characteristic of God? Because we're here. Why did God need to create us? What are we like a little ant farm for him to play with and feed and right? What are we? I can't explain this. Who can explain this? Why does God have to create us? Because he needs my prayers and my blessings and my praises, right? If not, he's not God, right? So the answer to that we give, we may be wrong because we're just little. You know, we're, like I say, always amoeba, us, and God's on the other side of the ocean. So the answer is that if God is this ultimate source of goodness, then goodness needs to give. Goodness needs to share. Goodness needs to to be good with others. You can't be the ultimate good if you keep it to yourself, right? So it's what the Kabbalah calls it, like a tzimtzum. God is mitzamtzem himself to make room for us, and we make our way into the universe. So our stories in Sefer Bereishis, where God appears. Okay, we have up to now it's been very easy to talk about God. Once you get to Parshas Chayesara, it's really quite difficult. There is no reference to God, except with Avram says God will send an angel to make you succeed in this endeavor. Right? So that is why Eliezer felt the chutzpah, if you will, to make up his plan. Let's go back now to Sarah, if you will. To chapter 23, where Avraham buries Sarah. There is a dispute in the Mefarshim and how to understand the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. Okay, let's look inside. Okay, and it's amazing. I mean, just by a curious show of hands, I know this shouldn't be taken in as too much of a morbid question, but how many people here don't know where you're going to be buried? Do you have a burial plot? No, right?
I haven't done.
You don't know so far? Yeah.
I mean, I think I'll
know the exact thing with the NAS.
If you're a member of Ohev Tzedek, you have a plot.
Yes.
Okay. Right? You have a plot in any one of three cemeteries. So, and for some reason, when we bought these plots about 100 some odd years ago, we bought enough for about 2,000 years. And now, with the amount of people dying per year now, we have enough for another 4,000 years, it seems. Wow. But the point is that Sarah dies apparently suddenly. This is perhaps why Chazal connect the death of Sarah to the Akedas Yitzchak. Not just because it happens in the Bible right afterwards, with the birth of Rivka sandwiched in between. So Chazal put all these stories together, and it leads to the just very unlikelihood that Yitzchak is 37 at the time of the Akedah, and Rivka is only 3 at the time of the marriage. It's a strange configuration. Let's leave that alone. When Rashi says Rivka was 3 when she married Yitzchak, I think he's trying to say something other than just the fact of her age. That's not a concern to us. Rashi, at the end of that parsha, indicates that he thinks Rivka is quite a bit older than 3.
Of course.
In certain statements he makes there. But this is an intricate part of Rashi's Parshanut. I say here that it seems from the text that Sarah died suddenly on Avraham. Mm-hmm. He didn't prepare for this, right? So it may make him think, I don't even know where I'm supposed to be buried. So he starts to...
Because they're nomadic people, we don't know where we'll be next day.
Yeah, but he's God told him to leave Mesopotamia for this area. He did also tell him something he knows already, that we're going to leave,
yes,
and come back. Right? It's very, very, why do we have to start peoplehood this way? Leave here for here. And by the way, you're not going to stay there either before your descendants come back. It's a strange configuration. Any question?
It's funny. I didn't know that she was living 127 years.
Yes.
127 years. So they know that she was... It was not age that you are old in that time?
Well, Avraham lived to be 175.
Huh?
Avraham lived to be 175. And Yitzchak lived to be 180. So, it's not, I wouldn't call it youth, but it's, she gave birth at 90. It seems to be sudden. He was caught off guard. So there's no place to bury her. And... Here is the question, the two different opinions of Pirkei Avos. What's in Pirkei Avos that has to do with this? The Pirkei Avos Mishnah says that Avram was tested 10 times in his life. The first test was to leave Mesopotamia to go to Canaan. And from there, there are great disputes over what the other tests were and whether or not he passed those tests. Right?
Yeah.
Okay, the Mishnah says he got 10 tests. It doesn't say whether he passed all of them or that he passed all of them with flying colors, right?
What now,
so the first is to leave Mesopotamia to go to Canaan. The second one is that as soon as he gets to Canaan, there's a famine. That's a challenge. Why did you, God, why did you tell me to leave? I was living comfortably, and you tell me to dafka, go to a place when there's a famine? And then there's a war there. And it says that this war has been fought for the last 25 years, which means that you're telling me to go not only to a famine zone, but a war zone. So these are all tests, right? Now, Rashi says he passed all of them. Now, what's interesting is, do you know that it is harder to get a zero on an SAT than to get a perfect 1600? You know that? You can't. No, true. I'm saying, but it's harder to get all the answers wrong than to get all the answers right.
Yes.
Right. Many more people get all the answers right than all the answers wrong. Okay. Well, it's obvious because no one's trying to get all the answers wrong. But I'm telling you this because no test is a zero-sum game. Are there any tests where you are? I remember in spelling, if you don't get a higher than a 90, you fail, or something like that. Remember that? So in some, but there's no such thing as if you don't get 100, you fail. There's no such thing. No one's at being a full tzaddik, right? So that's what the Mefarshim discuss. Because test number two for Avraham is to leave. That's test number one, but leave to a place where there's no food. So Rashi says, will he leave complaining, or will he leave not complaining? If that was test number two, then he passed, because he didn't complain, right? According to Ramban, test number two is not, is he going to complain about the famine? Test number two is, are you going to leave for the famine? So according to Ramban, Rashi did not pass test number two. Right, I'm not saying he got a zero, but he got a 65, a 64 or something, and now he got a 60, I wouldn't have the chutzpah to say this, but Ramban says that if you look at everything that happened to us in Egypt, it's all a little microcosm of what happens in the second test, right? Okay, that there's a famine, so Yaakov goes down. The men are mistreated, the women are taken in to hopefully the women will assimilate, and then Paro gets plagued, and then we leave with great, great wealth. So what I'm trying to get at here is that not everybody agrees as to what the tests were and whether he passed all the tests. What everyone agrees with is that he had 10. Mishnah Pirkei Avos says that Avraham had 10 tests. So what do you think was the last test of Avraham?
Makeda. Trial.
Because everybody says that's the 10th trial, everyone with Rashi, and right? Not so fast. There are even some Rishonim that say that the 10th trial is what's happening here. Okay, so we finished Akedas Yitzchok last week, so now we're moving into chapter 23. What is the trial here in chapter 23? Okay, but not everyone's wife dies. Sometimes your husband dies first.
That's a complete blood.
But men have always been dying before their wives.
It's the same day.
On average, I'm saying. And women always outnumbered men in the ancient world. But great numbers. Like, because of men were dying in battle and hunting accidents. And women were always living longer and always outnumbered men, which is why polygamy was reluctantly tolerated in the ancient world. So be that as it may, to say that the trial is how you're going to deal with your wife's death, I mean, look, you know, no one's supposed to die, chas v'shalom, in the lifetime of their parents, but we expect that, you know, in the linear, when you have siblings, a spouse, someone's got to die first. Right, so that I can't consider that. But what's the trial then?
Maybe how he treated the heflon.
So first of all, not everybody agrees that this is a trial. Yeah. But I'm just saying that those who don't think that the Akedas Yitzchok is the last trial say yes. What's going on?
Well, it says that it was outrageous that he had to bargain for
you know, to buy the land for a burial because God had promised all
right,
the land.
God had promised him all this land.
But that doesn't make sense to him. He didn't have the land.
Now, that might not be a claim against the Hittites who controlled this area.
Right.
But that's a claim against God. God, you told me this land is mine.
Already.
Why am I having such trouble finding a place to bury my wife? Mm-hmm. You know, Yitzchak has a trial. He can't find a place to draw water. Why are we having such trouble in the land you promised us? Now, we already learned back in Lech Lecha that Lot behaved in a way that said, well, we can walk around here as if though we own this land, right? Mm-hmm. But the Avos never behaved that way. Yaakov was very, very upset about the way Shechem, you know, his sons behaved with Shechem, and we're guests here still. This is not our land, right? So you know, Lot's shepherds behaved as if though they owned the land already. Avraham is we're running around here. It's not just a question of finding a place. It seems that the people here would like very much for him to be in their midst.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
I'll get back right back to that. Get right back to that thought.
Something is good here because Rebecca is here. You have the name Rebecca.
No, okay.
It's good.
Rivka is not born yet. Rivka is not born yet at this point.
But we're in the beginning. Here.
Yeah, Rivka. I'm sorry. She's born, but we don't know her yet. She's born just in the chapter before, but that Rashi says that that's just mentioned so that we can recognize her later. Right. And then she gets introduced, you know, in reality. But in our story, Moshe, you have a question?
Final one, Isaac will be attached. He can't run his legacy. No such easy thing to do.
So I don't see that the finding a wife. I think that works well for Avram. I don't see that as any test. He sends out someone, find me a wife, and he succeeds. You know, a test is in the 10 tests are things where Avram struggles and is challenged, and he goes, is this the best way, God? But I don't see it. It's not a test that he sent out his servant to find a wife who was very successful and found a good wife for him.
But Eliezer was a Canaanite slave, and he wanted to propose his own methods to take on this.
Yeah, okay. You know, that's a drash that he wanted. He wanted Yitzchak for his own daughter, but I would just.
People still say Reuma from today, and she was here, mistress. And they say Reuma.
Yeah, I don't know.
Everybody
those
have Reuma today, so.
No, that's just.
I thought it's a good name. Yes. Here I see she was a previous.
Yeah, no, these names, remember, are Aramean names from Avraham's distant relatives. Right? Okay.
So,
yeah, so.
Roma, you have all the time Roma.
Yeah, the Muslims, the Arabs took it from the Arabs took it from this section here. Okay, let me just get back to my original my question here. The Hittites are anxious to have Avraham bury his dead, but they keep saying, if you look very carefully in the pasuk, especially pasuk vav, let's read it. Right, it says that the Hittites responded to Avraham as such. I call the Hittites; they're called bnei ches, but no, that's what they are. Shma'enu, you see it, everybody? Pasuk Vav?
Yes.
Shma'enu Adoni Nesi Elokim Ata Besochenu. We recognize that you are a. We heard stories about how you defeated the four kings that no one else could defeat, and you saved your nephew. And every story about Avraham was grandiose. And
so
we want very much for you to be in our midst. Mm-hmm. So, what kind of test is this? They say, we want you to take the choicest of our burial plots. We want you to take right. No one's, you know, today if you want to be better, you have to make a choice. You have to see who you want to be next to. I don't want to be next to him. I don't want to be next to him. So you know, you have a whole field, and you can take plot numbers and you can take row numbers, and if you want four next to each other, you have to be careful. No, there's only three room for three in that row, and there's only room for you know, this is 120 years old. It's been going on for a long time. So I can imagine this is not just a glach and the velterai and a place to bury. This is a cemetery. Mm-hmm. This is a place where there are people there. And if you want a place for your wife, Mistama, you want a place for yourself, mm-hmm. and maybe your children, maybe your grandchildren, right? So you gotta take a big enough place. So we have that for you. We will not hold back anything from you. So why Avraham pushes back? But it's not even clear what he's pushing back on. What is Avraham finding that their proposal doesn't fit my agenda? He says we have the choicest of our burial plots. No one will stand up to you, unless someone's already buried there, of course. But whatever, you need 6 plots, you need 8, you need 12, you need 16, you tell us, we'll find a spot for you. All right? Sure, if you go look at the Ohev Tzedek plots, there's some places, if you dafka want there, you only have room for 2 or 3. But if you want in the open space, you have room for 32 if you want. Right? You take the whole row. You just, you got to reserve it. So Avraham is told at the outset, doesn't sound like a test at all. All right? Okay, I want a spoiler alert right now from the outset. Do you remember how much Avraham ends up paying for this?
400 shekel kesef.
400 shekel kesef. I got to tell you, 700 years from now, someone at the end of Sefer Shoftim is offered a job that pays 10 shekel a year.
Wow.
Okay? Now, that was but that also was room and board, and it was a Levite job. So that probably was, I'm just saying, you know, probably just something, you know, just a simple basic allowance. 400 shekel at this time, it's kesef, it's silver, is the salary of a few years ask yourself what you make, right? And say, am I making 2 or 3 years? That's what I have to pay for a family plot? That's a lot of money. Mm-hmm. What made it that Avram had to pay so much in the end? First they come up to this with this great, great offer here. No, they're not. Look, at some point they're offering him without payment.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Right?
That's why I was confused. I thought if Avram talked to people, Avram talked to God, because he said Adonai.
No, that's my master. Adonai. Take a look. No, careful. Careful.
My master. Our master.
Okay.
It's like Guru.
Yeah.
Now, it pasuk tests with Avraham's counter proposal, where he says, I don't want to deal with anyone but Ephron ben Sofar. Why? What do you know about him?
He's the leader.
Nothing.
So here is what I would suggest from the storyline, is the reason why he wants Ephron is because he heard that Ephron has a burial plot in the only place he's willing to use. Look at Pasuk Tes. Because of those two words,
we've
been very, very careful. Even the most assimilated Jews get all of a sudden become more careful when it comes to the time of burial.
Yes.
Right? Even if not in the rituals of burial, but where they're buried. I want to be buried with the family, or the buried, you know, things like that. And Avraham says, I want to be b'k'tzei seder, because I know that I'm here, I'm a guest here. The Hittites are controlling the land here. And I do expect one time to be back here. Mm-hmm. 200 years, 400, I don't know how long it's going to be. God told me 400 years we're going to spend out of the land. Right? So it ended up being considerably less than that. But Avraham says, and just by the way, as we're talking, you could just tingle to feel, hey, wait a second, we have this place. We're still, what other nation has such a thing? 3,000 years later, we're still this place called Hebron where we go to pray where Avraham is buried and where Sarah is buried. Is that amazing?
Maybe also they still got separation from the people of the land. There is a big separation.
So that's why he wants B'k'tzei Sadeo, because he knows, he sees what they want. Yeah. Hittites want this great Avraham, which is the same Svara as the people of Shechem. Yes. Tell me, what is that? What did the people of Shechem
fight
say?
With the woman and the children.
Yes, so what did they say? What did they say to make it palatable to the people. Listen, you've got to mutilate yourselves.
We'll get it. We'll own them.
We'll own them. They'll mix it up with us. They'll take our daughters. We'll take their daughters. The price is you got to take a circumcision. But that's small potatoes compared to this is an important.
Isn't too bad being also there to show them?
So the way that the people of Shechem talk, because the Tanakh reveals to us, I can understand a little bit that the king had to that Shechem had to talk this way to convince his people to do this, right? They weren't so open to taking a circumcision. Not the easiest thing in the world to do, to convince grown men to do. So he's had to tell them, but still, the Torah reveals to us a bit of truth that the people there recognize that these new people coming in, right,
are something special.
And maybe if we cast our lot with them, no, that's not the question. Let's force them to cast their lot with us, and it'll be good for us, right? Now, not everyone behaves this way, I got to tell you, in Sefer Bereishis. Remember, the Philistine king says, Leich me'imanu ki otzamto mimenu me'od. Right? Get out of here. You've become so much more successful than us. And the anti-Semitism just manifests itself with, just get out of here. Right? But what's interesting is that this is much lesser, pointed out to a lesser extent, is that afterwards, when the king goes to Yitzchak afterwards, and he says, we see that you're an important person. We see God walks with you, and he says, why did you send for me? Vatem snei semosi, v'teshalchuni me'itchem. You hate me and you cast me before. So this is a beautiful sense. You should always, when you. This is a crucial point for Jewish history. The king says, "Ra'o ra'inu ki haya Hashem imach, tihino Allah beinu seinu beneinu venecha v'nichusav risimach." We see that you're a holy people. We see that your godliness walks with you. We want to make a deal with you. All right, so get out of here because you're succeeding. The Philistines thought for a second and said, "You know what? Maybe it's better if they stay with us. Maybe we could learn from them about their successes." Right? So Ephraim ben Sochar is called upon because he's got the plot of land, the only one that I'm interested in. Mm-hmm. I don't want any other, because if they want me, Besocha Soder, right, to be right in the middle with everyone else, that's not what I want. I don't want my descendants coming to this place. We can't tell today where that was. There are all kinds of attempts to see, where was the other plot. I mean, Hebron is not so big. It wasn't so big then. And, where was that? But we know where it is now. But by the time Avraham insists on getting the spot that he wants, which is, you could say, Asadeh, so that's gonna cost. Once he can see that he wants it on his terms, so, that's what...
pay money.
When someone knocks on your door and he says, how much do you want for your house? So, you can all of a sudden, let me see what he thinks. I know it's worth $800,000, but let me ask for $2.4 million. Maybe let me see how much he wants it. Okay, I'll take it. So once Ephraim ben Sochar sees that it's, I'm in the driver's seat... So then he says, well, what's 400 shekel kesef? Because he knows that Avram's not going to bargain with him at that point. Right? And he doesn't. Yeah. And by the way, Avram does know how to bargain. Right?
Yes.
Remember with, taking, bargaining God down from 50 to 10.
Yes.
Right? It was pretty good work in the shuk there, right? So Avram, did not have any qualms about paying this extra amount. So he finally does get to Beri Sara, and the story is over quite quickly. Okay? Now there's one.
What is the test?
That he had to pay so much for something that was in land that was already his.
Oh.
and that it did involve some. You know, why do we say today when Chas v'Shalom someone's close relative dies, right? You're called an onein, right? You're not allowed to do mitzvahs. You're potter from all mitzvahs, right?
Yeah.
You're not counted in the minion. You're not. Okay.
Bye-bye. Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Enjoy every second to you.
Come again. Okay. So Avraham he has to go through such trouble where today you have a chevra kadisha to do those things,
mm-hmm.
and there's a reason why when we don't do mitzvahs. It was a very difficult time.
Mm-hmm.
That's why we rushed to do funerals, right? I didn't want to eat anything. The halacha says you're not supposed to make a bracha. And I must say that whole morning. We had the funeral very early in the morning. I kept making brachas. And before I ate food, because I had to like make the concerted effort. And here's Avram running, and he's not no youngster himself, you know. And he's running and running around and dead bargaining with his wife's burden upon on his the death of his wife laying across his shoulder. So that could be a test. God, what do you have? What? Okay, so... And I understand why everyone thinks the Akedah is the 10th test, because if you're going to get 10 tests, surely the 10th should be the biggest one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, after the Akedah, you're hitting me with this relatively smug where someone could ask, so what's the test? You know, that you asked. It wasn't a bad question. You know, all right, but
losing a loved one, I mean, that's
right, but the 10th test should be like the first. Something that involves the land of Israel. Okay, this land is mine, God. You promised it to me. So why do I have such trouble finding it just on a small little corner, Dal Amos, to bury my wife? Right. So that is how it ends, like it begins. Yes. Question.
And like the father of the nation, he had to think for his descendants. So that's big.
Yeah. Right. So the Akedah certainly does that, Akedat Yitzchak, the story just before this, where God tells him, this child is your future, not any other child you've had. Remember, Avram is going to have 12 more children after this, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So, but right now he doesn't know that.
12 or 6?
There's 12 Nisim, so the 12 Nisim from Ishmael, but he has a whole series with Keturah. It's more than 6.
You
can check it out at the end of Pesach. Okay, whatever it is, he marries someone else and has more children with her. So. Okay. Yes. Okay. So. Yitzchak is his future, God says, and then that the crescendo of his test should be now this you're going to lose that future. So that's the greatness of Avram, but that's what we did the last 3 weeks. Okay, so
even the idea of saying that this is a test because you gave me this land, so how come I'm having such trouble? But who said that God gave him a land in a way that it was going to like as a nace come to him, rather than I'm giving it to you and you're going to acquire it in a normal manner by working and paying and da-da-da-da, whatever.
Okay, I'm sure he did all those things all these years. He hasn't been you know, he was 75 when he got there. He's 137 now.
And
you'd think in 60 years,
giving him the land.
Okay. All right. I close with it. This. I'm just going to do Yitzchak for this 1 week. Because next week we're already moving on to Yaakov.
Okay.
Maybe a little bit with Yitzchak still and Parshas Toldos, but we're going in order of the text. So it's a very interesting thing. Hashem changes Avram's name to Avraham.
Mm-hmm.
He changes Yaakov's name to Yisrael. And these names are all instructive. You don't just change a name, just Lach Nebelterein, right? Although I will tell you this, sometimes a king, like the king of Egypt, changes El Yoakim to Yehoyakim. Nebuchadnezzar changes Matanya to Tzidkiyahu. Paro changes Yosef to Tzofnas Paneach. In these instances, it could just be I determine what your name is, because I'm the king. I'm the determinant for you. Some Mephoshim say that that's what Moshe did with Yahushua. Yahushua, this is a sign. At this early, I expect you to be my successor, and I'm changing your name to let everybody know that you're special. Okay. Now, okay, once the name is changed, then the good Mephoshim try to say, why was the name changed from A to B? But there are a lot of name changes going on in the Torah and in the Tanakh. Also, when the Nebuchadnezzar changes Daniel's name and his three friends, remember that? Baal, Shatzar, and Abednego, all those names, right? So of all this, it's fascinating that Yitzchak goes without a name change. Why isn't God changing Yitzchak's name? Yitzchak's name is, Yitzchak is, it's based on the Sarah and Avram's laughter when hearing that he would be born. What's the, it's not a great... Okay, let's see where you're going with this.
Wasn't his name given by Hashem?
That's it. Yes. Hashem doesn't have to change his name because this is one of a few names in Tanakh that Hashem told in advance what the person would be named. Do you know who the others are?
Ishmael
as well. Shlomo, God tells David, your son will be a man of peace. He will build me the temple. So it seems that that's how Shlomo gets in there. And also Yoshiyahu, the name Yoshiyahu was given long before he was born. He's a king at the end of Sefer Melachim. But Yitzchak is already named by Hashem. Who? Shmuel? No, Chana just names him when he's born. But Ishmael, God tells Hagar, I want you to call his name Ishmael because I heard your voice, right? Before he's born. Usually a child is named after they're born.
Yeah.
So these are four names that seem to be given before the person is born. Okay, so that is a little background on Yitzchak. So that these are the decisions of progeny, the decisions of how the next generation is coming about. Yitzchak gets very little press time in Sefer Bereishis. By the time we get to Eilat Toldos Yitzchak and Yaakov Esav Hamor Beparsha, the whole story is about Yaakov and Esav. But next week, God does come back to the story significantly. God is talking to Yitzchak at every turn, as if though Yitzchak can't do anything without God telling him to do it or not to do it. So we're going to discuss that next week in Yitzchak Hashem. And we'll see especially the role played by the wife in determining the future, right? Like Sarah tells Avraham, my Ishmael is not going to inherit with my son Yitzchak. And next week, of course, we'll see what Rivka does with that. And this one fascinating point is that when God talks to Rivka about the future, we're going to really try to analyze what he tells her, and it's going to be cryptic.
Yeah.
And why wasn't God more clear with his message to Rivka? You'd think, it's quite clear, I know what he told her. He said the younger one will prevail over the older one. Not so fast, it's not so clear. All right, we'll see that adds to some of not so much confusion, but some of the confounding nature of these two very, very, complex characters of Yaakov and Esav. Okay? And we'll see some of how that plays out. Okay. Marv, yes, Marv upstairs.